Welcome back to the Verified Athletics Podcast. Currently working on a new article that talks about options for athletes that don't have the grades they need to get into the schools they want. So look for that to come out sometime in February. Over 2,000 of the top high school football players have been accepted into our database, the Verified Watch List, where over 130 colleges go to get recruiting information. So if someone you know has the ability and desire to play college football, and they're not signed up yet, they need to get on there now, upload their film link and their transcript for college coaches to evaluate. If you're enjoying the podcast, please support it by spreading the word. You can subscribe and rate the show on iTunes. You can tell a friend or family member to give it a shot, or you can just share it on your own social media accounts. My guest today is Rob Palmer. Rob is a former Division I football player. He's the founder of Be Exceptional Fitness, where he coaches people on strength, conditioning, motivation. I had a great time recording the podcast, and I'm sure you'll enjoy listening to it. Here we go. All right, welcome to the Verified Athletics Podcast. We have Rob Palmer on. Rob is awesome. We met quite a while ago now. Rob played for me when I was coaching at Fordham, and now he's off doing a bunch of cool things. So actually, Rob, what are you up to now?
Nate, and you know, prior to this conversation, I asked if I can drop the coach title for you. So currently right now I'm a personal trainer here in New York City. So, you know, after college, from when we last were together, I started my own fitness company, and originally worked out of a box gym here in the city, and then eventually made my way to the independent space. And now I run a company that, you know, does everything from nutritional coaching, concierge-like services in the health and wellness space, and travel and live life. That's in a nutshell. I don't want to get into too much detail because I think that's going to come out later.
So you intrigued me there at the end. You said travel. Where are you going these days?
Oh, man. So there's currently nothing new for this year, but I can go back, you know, maybe the past 2 years, 2.5 years.
Yeah, tell me.
So since graduating, one, I didn't grow up having a passport, right?
In Texas, right?
Yeah, grew up in Texas. Just to give you some background on myself. So I grew up in a town called Grand Prairie, Texas. My whole family graduated from either one or two high schools, South Grand Prairie or North Grand Prairie.
Is that a rivalry in the family?
It's a big rivalry, right? But it's funny because it's literally only two high schools. I think now, since I've been gone, it's been 10 years now, that there have been some like tech schools that have been developed and things like that, and gave kids other options that they can choose from if they didn't want to choose those two amazing schools. But they were huge. They were huge schools. It was a town that, you know, the town shut down when the Friday Night Lights came on. But my family, you know, we were what I would call us country, right? A lot of us didn't really travel outside the state, let alone travel outside the country borders. So having a passport, it was something that I didn't even think about until I came to New York, which was for me a dream since I was like very, very young, watching the ball drop and things like that. So when I made my way to New York, and after I graduated Fordham, so I had been in New York for 4 years then, I was like, you know what? Let me get my passport. Let me start traveling. So since then, I've visited France, Spain, the UK, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, DR, Mexico, Jamaica, Trinidad, Tobago, Egypt, Israel, and Canada. And because it's completely different, I would say California. but those are the places. And so hopefully there's more in counting. I think I want to definitely do some places in West Africa. We have some friends that my lady and I have some friends that just moved to West Africa. And so, you know, and then also as well as South Africa. So but we'll see. We'll see.
So this actually ties well into probably your football playing experience, because I got to think that you got recruited out of, you know, your town in Texas that you had probably not traveled much farther away from. Mm-hmm. And then you went all the way to New York City to go to school. I imagine you made it sound like there was a piece of you that like that was the draw to go to Fordham. Is that does that sound right?
No, that was 100% correct. I mean, so every year, and this is the one of the most vivid memories, and I have a couple from around this same time frame. Every single year, around New Year's, my family would watch the ball drop. We would do the same for the Thanksgiving Day parade, right? We would always do this, and we would always ask, is it really like that? Like, is New York really how it is on TV, or is this special effects or whatever it may be? And like, I remember being as young as like 3, 4, and 5 and watching these things on TV with my grandmother, who has had a huge influence on my life, and just asking those questions. And I would always be at awe when we would see the lights and think that it was almost like fictional in a movie like. And so, yeah, as I got older and I realized obviously it was real, and recruiting season started and coaches started showing interest. When I first started getting interest from schools in the Northeast, I was like, okay, all right, we're getting closer to New York. Right when I found the one from New York, I'm taking it.
So you had a crush on New York. You'd never been to New York though before your official visit?
I had never been. I was the closest I came to coming to New York was being in New Jersey. So I did live. My father lives in New Jersey. He now does sports broadcasting at the collegiate level at Temple University. And he lives literally right over the bridge from Philadelphia. And so I spent a year and about a half there, but that was the closest.
God, so you were so close. You could.
I know, right? I could have took the Amtrak. If I knew what I knew now, I could have took the Amtrak, right? Or the New Jersey Transit. But that was the closest, and I was, you know, just in reach. But you know, that was it.
How old were you when you were living in South Jersey?
This was sophomore year. Sophomore year for me, what is that, 3 years after 09, around 15, 16.
Was that tough to get your high school kind of like jolted like that way, where you started in one place, went to Jersey and came back?
Well, I think at that point I had been used to it. So, you know, I think every athlete has something that motivates them. So I just revealed one of the things, which was seeing New York and wanting to use my abilities and my talent to escape. I wouldn't even say escape, to give myself an opportunity to explore outside of my state lines. And so my mom, who was a single mother growing up, it was my mom, my younger brother, who was 6 years younger than I was. You know, she was a hardworking woman, right? We didn't have the best economic situation, right? And there were times where I did bounce around in elementary schools, which is not a bad thing, because I made a ton of friends. I have a lot of people that I know in so many different cities around Grand Prairie, Texas. But I went to, just to go back a little bit, I actually attended 4 elementaries, two junior high schools and 3 high schools, actually. So by that time, I was like, you know what? It's just another move for me. I'm going to be able to adjust. Even if I'm not able to make friends, I know I'm an amazing athlete. So that's going to get my foot in the door to at least people accepting me in their community. So and for me, when I moved to New Jersey, the one thing that did take me back was when I found out how many seniors they were graduating, right? When you say you're graduating only 112, 115 seniors, because that's how small or how big the school is, regardless, you know, depending on who you are, compared to a South Grand Prairie, who we had close to 1,000 kids graduating, it's a huge difference.
Yeah.
Right? It's a huge difference in your high school experience, your education experience, the competition, your athletic experience. Okay. We played in a bowl. In high school, we played in a bowl.
Yeah, Jersey's got a strange, strange like state championship system. It's all messed up. New Jersey's got, I think, about 20 state champions. I think that's about right.
Because it's like Group One, which I think in Texas we don't even have a Group One.
No, it's like totally different. In Texas, it's like it is in most states, where they divide up schools statewide based on size of school. Texas, I feel like they probably divide up into about 8 or 9 different levels, although they count it like as 5 or 6, but then there's like, once you get to 5 or 6, and there's like even differentiations like in there. I think that's how it works.
Well, it's I think it starts at 4A. It goes 4A, 5A, and then I think in some areas it may be a 6A.
Right.
Okay. And then there's like private school.
Yeah.
But
Jersey is totally messed. Jersey does like that same thing, but then they also divide the state regionally into like four different regions that they call groups. And so like you have like the different divisions as far as size of school, but then even if you make it all the way to the end of like and win the last game of the year for your like size of school, you still are really only playing in schools from like your quarter of the state.
Yes. Yes. Correct.
So that, and I think New Jersey is pretty unique like that. New York's state has like something similar because the city doesn't play against the other schools and Long Island doesn't play against the other schools. And so you have like basically the rest of the state, they have like a state championship, and then New York City has a state championship and then a city championship. And then you have the Long Island, they have their own thing. So it's kind of, so New York's like that too. But I think most states, almost every other state, maybe California divides it in half too, I think, where there's like Northern California championship and Southern California championship. But that always changes anyway.
But California is huge too. So that, I think that would kind of make sense.
Texas is huge too.
Yeah, I guess.
But I think Texas has like this culture when it comes to high school football that's pretty unique. I mean, I think that they're like obviously pretty well known for it. I think Ohio, Western Pennsylvania-ish can like, you know, is like nipping at the heels of that type of culture, that Friday Night Lights culture. But yeah, they're Texas, you know, I've never really recruited Texas, so you probably know more about Texas high school football than I do, but it seems like a cool thing. What was it like growing up playing Friday Night Lights, Texas?
Oh my gosh.
First of all, how close is it to the movie or the TV show if you're not me and you watch the show?
Well, I have the movie and the show, it's funny. I actually enjoyed the show. I have this thing to where I never get past the first season. I watch the first season, I'm like, okay, I got it. And the movie was, it was a great movie, you know, for theatrical effects and, you know, I think there were a lot of things that were fabricated. And the only reason I say it is because my high school coach, my defensive back coach, was the actual quarterback for Dallas Carter. Okay.
Yeah.
So this guy, Coach Robert Hall, who I'm pretty sure is still coaching in Texas, was a Texas Tech Hall of Famer. Okay. He went to Dallas Carter. He was the quarterback that they were referencing from Dallas Carter during that Odessa state championship run. And when the movie came out, we asked him like, how true is it? He said, we blew them boys out. We blew them boys out. He said, and it wasn't even the final. It wasn't the state championship. It was the quarterfinals. And it wasn't close. So, you know, like, but I think they did capture the intensity, the sentiment behind, you know, whole cities, whole towns coming together. Everybody knows everyone's name. And whether you're a man, whether you're a woman, whether you're a child, whether you're an adult, you enjoy it just as much as you may enjoy college or professional football, right? And I know there was a statistic recently, because we just had our state championship in Texas, that I want to say the DeSoto game, right? I forgot who they were playing with. I'm so disconnected right now. Maybe was top five as far as total attendance in comparison, or it was comparable to some of these collegiate games, collegiate championships that were happening, right? Which is crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Right? High school football games selling out the old Cowboys Stadium. Think about that.
Yeah.
You know, and growing up, I used to witness that. So growing up, I used to go and see, you know, I remember specifically, was it Lincoln University playing at the Cowboys Stadium, and the whole stadium just in uproar when they would see crazy plays happening, right? Super engaged, almost more engaged than what you would see at a Cowboys game back then, right? So at the age of 7, 8, and 9, when I first started playing, that's what I wanted. I always wanted that, right? And, you know, when I started playing football, a lot of it came from me taking what I was doing in my grandmother's apartment complex, playing on the street, playing in the grass, playing throw up tackle, where you throw up the ball and run around. I would play with a bunch of older kids, and then transferring that over to the football field. And I took a very big likening to the game, and it helped me kind of continue to pursue it, because I was so good. I was like, I'm good. I'm faster than most guys older than me, you know. Let me pursue this in school and maybe potentially do this at the professional level if I'm good enough. But my experience was incredible. It was incredible, you know?
Yeah. So what does it feel like to be in that environment as a high school football player? Is it like too much too soon, or is it just like amazing, or is it like maybe different people have different experiences? What did it feel like for you?
It was pretty normal. And the reason is because, again, like I say, you know, we graduated close to 1,000 seniors, right? And in that area in Grand Prairie, like I said, my family all went to the same high school. So a lot of the people that were in the audience, they already knew who I was, and I knew who they were. The only people we didn't know was the opposing team, right? And then even there was some overlap there too, right? Because my parents or, you know, may have known the parents of the opposing teams and things like that. So unless we got to maybe the playoffs and we played somebody that was far out west, far out east, it was comfortable because we were playing against people we played against maybe our whole lives, you know? So it wasn't as nerve wracking as like as the person may think outside looking in.
What is it? Like the feeling I always get from watching the movies and the TV shows about Texas high school football is if you're a good player on the football team, you can get away with anything in that town. And like people will cut you slack and you can, does that mirror reality at all?
All right. So I had a couple different experiences. So because I went to three different high schools, my experiences were different, especially because they were at different stages of my life. Right. So, my freshman year, I was at one specific high school and, you know, no one really knows me there. Right. I didn't really make a name for myself yet. And so there was no pull to be had. Right. When I moved to Jersey, you know, fortunately, my father was the coach. He was one of the coaches. Right. So I kind of got away with some stuff. Not with him. I mean, you know, the first game that I played underneath him, he cussed me out and he said, I don't want you talking anymore because you're doing all this talking and you ain't showing up on the field. Right. And this is a sophomore. And so but when I did get to my last 2 years and I moved back to Texas to play at South Grand Prairie. And the teachers did know me. I mean, you know, me personally, I had pull maybe in the school. I don't know if it was in the whole town or the whole city, but the school definitely, because National Honor Society, Student Council, Varsity Show Choir, Varsity Football, Varsity Track, Varsity Basketball, right? And so my face was around the whole high school. And, you know, I was, you know, not to get anybody in trouble, I guess it doesn't matter now, but there were some
statute times limitations are out on that one.
Exactly. So there were some times to where I did sleep in for my first and second period, knowing that I had coaches in those times, or if it was a day after a game or something like that, or, you know, whatever it may be, you know, I may have showed up a little bit later than what I was supposed to and didn't get pinned for it a couple times.
What if, you know, you were at a party and you got caught drinking, and maybe it wasn't, you know, maybe this doesn't apply to you, but maybe it applies to people that you know, and the cops show up and they see that it's the starting quarterback or the starting running back. Is it more likely to be a slap in the wrist and get them on their way because of like that? That's like the feeling I get from watching Friday Night Lights or these other movies.
I mean, I'm sure in some areas it was like that. The only thing I can relate to, so I didn't do any type of recreational anything, right? I was, you know, kind of corny. I was like a goody-goody. Like my thoughts were like performing well in the classroom and performing well on the football field and getting as many girls as possible. Like that was my thing, right? But like, you know, as I think aggressive boys do, like we would fight and we wouldn't get as in much trouble for doing that. That's the only thing I could attest to, as opposed to somebody who wasn't a part of that brotherhood or that team and represented the school. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, I want to take you back because we started getting on this tangent because you're talking about traveling and how being in New York City was like a thing that I think probably I would say, and you probably would agree, had a huge influence on your desire to travel and your idea that that actually is a thing. And you had wanted to go to New York your whole life. And so did Fordham find you or did you find Fordham?
Oh, wow. It was wild how Fordham found me. So Fordham definitely found me. And, you know, I think as you're doing this, you know, your verified athletics, you know that it's sometimes there's a disconnect on how players can reach out to coaches and how coaches can find players. And this is why what you were doing, you and your partner are doing, is important, right? So because I bounced around at three different high schools, my name was kind of in circulation. But the thing is, I wasn't at a designated spot like most kids that I knew who were all Americans. I played with all Americans who had been at the same school for 4 years or whatever it may be, right? And so coaches can follow them from when they're freshmen. So I went from one city to a different state to a completely different city that I was in my high school, right? Now, I did do camps. I did the Russell's 100 camp. I did go to Temple University's camp because I thought that was one of the, you know, top places that I wanted to go at one point because my father went there. But the way in which Fordham found me, when I moved back to Texas my junior year, the team was pretty much set. And even though I was a great player, I still had to prove myself. And in comparison to New Jersey, where kids are allowed to play both sides of the ball, you had to play one side because our team was that big. So when I moved to Texas, I had to make a choice on what I wanted to do, right? In order for them to see my talent, because a lot of these coaches, they knew me from old clippings when I played back when I was in junior high and elementary in that area. They were like, are you still any good? We don't have anything on you. So they had me play on JV when I first moved back to Texas. And I played on JV for maybe two or three games. And literally they were like, okay, we got to get you back on varsity. We got to find a way, whether it be running the rock as a running back or playing corner as a defensive back. You have the perfect body type for corner. And just so happened when they were making that decision, a senior cornerback went down. Okay. So I got the spot, right? And I'll bring this full circle. So I got the spot and I played. Didn't really set the world on fire, but I was a solid corner, right? I got the job done. I didn't have any big catches or anything. You know, I had a couple pass deflections. And then when that senior corner came back, the other corner got hurt his ankle. So then I still had a starting job. So I ended up starting my whole junior season because of injury, right? When we got
and then,
to the
spring, actually, let me pause you real quick for context, because I think this is relevant. Mm-hmm. Two things. Number one, how many players from your high school go on to play Division I football?
Like, well, my whole senior class, my whole defense went Division I.
Okay, so like I think that context is important to this conversation because someone that's listening is like, so he went to go play Division I football and he barely, you know, he wouldn't have even been a starter his junior year, but like that gives it some context for some people.
Yeah, we you know, my class alone, and I know there was some others that, you know, we had a lot of guys went to SEC, right? And in my class alone, we had All-American who went to University of Texas. We had an All-American who went to Kansas State. We had an All-American who went to Kentucky, right? And then we had a lot of guys who went to Division I AAs and things like that, right? In Oklahoma and, you know, in various places around Texas and things like that. So, yeah, we had some A1 players, very good players.
And this is like 2008, 2009-ish, I would imagine?
Yeah, yep. Okay. Mm-hmm, exactly.
And because like I think that even now, the idea that an FCS school would recruit an athlete that was not like a standout in his junior year is like, you know, from a school like that, I think it's still possible. But I think that nowadays, that back then that was much more common. Now I think it's even less so. Now like your junior year matters a lot more at the FCS level.
Yeah. I mean, even at that point, it did matter. And I always thought it mattered. And that's probably why I made it a point to try to stand out as much, because I'm like, all right, I'm getting back submerged in Texas football. It's very competitive and I can get buried in the roster. And I did not want, so literally I was grinding my butt off. But so take it to the spring going into my senior year, I didn't get any written letters like a lot of these other guys were getting, right? So mind you, so in South Grand Prairie, we had two freshman teams, okay? We had an A team and a B team for two freshman teams. We had a sophomore team, a JV team, and a varsity team. So come the spring of my junior year, where a lot of these big schools come to visit the campus and they line up during our spring practice and they line up during our spring games, everybody knew you had to be on your game, okay? So the moment for me, and I don't even know if this player knows this, but I think he knows, I was guarding a player. This is, I think, maybe even a practice, a one-on-one drill, a live scrimmage or something like that. We may have done like three live scrimmages. And a player by the name of Dwayne Peace, phenomenal athlete. He was an offensive player who went Division I. And Fordham, to my understanding, was actually looking at him. Okay.
Okay.
But there was, I mean, there was a lot of bigger, there was bigger schools, much bigger schools that were looking at. So he was on my side. I was the boundary corner. He was our number one receiver. So literally we were going at it the whole scrimmage, right? And they saw my one-on-one coverage. They saw my zone coverage. They saw how physical I can get. They saw, you know, that I played with a chip on my shoulder, even though he was the MVP, Nike MVP nationwide, right? Immediately after that scrimmage, University of it wasn't Mac Brown, but University of Texas came. I got a card from them. North Texas, I got a card from them. Fordham, I got a card from them, right? It was Coach Brian Volk, okay? Right? He was there. Now, that's the first time I met him. Rice University, got a card from them. I think his name was Eric White, right? So there was a couple schools. I think I may have left that exact day with like 10 cards from like 10 well-known schools. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And then soon after, they were like, look, you have to have a solid senior year. And then I started getting handwritten letters. So then it wasn't until my junior year, not even during the year, but during the spring, to where I started actually getting letters from schools that weren't just questionnaires. Because, you know, everybody knows, like, a questionnaire isn't nothing. Questionnaire isn't anything, right? You know, kids want to say, oh, I got a questionnaire. No, I was getting handwritten letters from these schools.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know? Not everyone knows that that's nothing. But you're right, it is nothing.
And so I'm getting letters. I'm getting recruited. No, that's not recruited. That's a questionnaire. That's nothing. Yeah. They send that out to almost every single kid, you know, in your area. So that was my kind of claim to fame. And so after that, you know, they were like, yeah, like, you know, you did very well. He was one of our top recruits. We're still looking at him, but we don't think that we'll probably be able to get him because, you know, he has his eyesights on, you know, bigger schools. And that was all she wrote.
Yeah. So you're just, so at this point, you're in the summer before your senior year, they're saying you got to have a great senior season. And I imagine at this point, you're like, you're kind of on the radar for all these schools, but no one's ready to pull the trigger.
Yeah, exactly.
And, and they're keeping in contact with you. You're probably like a backup plan or like a kind of, it's probably some sort of mix of like a backup plan and like, let's see how his senior season goes and see like where he shakes out. So you're on, and at that time, do you think you realized that that's where you stood, or do you think that you thought that things were a lot rosier than that? You were about to get offers for everyone.
I knew for a fact that's where I stood.
Yeah.
I knew for a fact that's where I stood 100%. And my coach, the same coach, Robert Hall, who was my defensive, he said, Robert, and he was very clunky. He had a certain way of talking that almost sounded poetic, right? He, you know, Robert, I'm letting you know right now, you better bring your A game or you're going to be sitting in the stands with your mama, point blank, right? And he would tell me, and that's how he would talk, and it was real. And so he was like, these coaches that are going to come, they're going to watch you. They're going to watch you play football. They're going to watch you play basketball, and they're going to watch you run track this year. They want to see how you can compete, right? And so I knew that every single game I had to be like zoned in and focused on my play.
And then did you end up with more options in Fordham and chose Fordham, or is that the one that came through?
Yes. So when it came down, if I can recall, it was Fordham University, Temple University, Rice University, and I want to say Bucknell University, who was also in the Patriot League, right? So it was very, very random, right? And so the ones that I stayed in contact with towards the end were literally Fordham and Temple. And I actually had a conversation with Temple while I was on my visit to Fordham. And the thing is, they're a bigger school. I was late on their radar. And I think it did help because my father was a Hall of Famer there. But they were very happy with my performance that I had there. You know, I think at their camp, I may have ran like a 4.67 with a pulled hamstring, right? It was during track season. I told them, like, look, I just pulled my hamstring, da 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 da, and I still did well. All the drills, the one-on-one drills, I did extremely well. But they were like, look, like, you know, we want to recruit a kid off the bat, you know, running a 4.4, 4.3. We understand you're hurt, but like that, it is what it is, you know? And so when I came for my visit to Fordham, in the parking lot, I had a conversation with their coach, Coach Williams, right? Defensive back coach. And right, it looked like, you know, you were late on the radar. We do really like you. You did really well at the camp, but you know, the best that we think that we'll be able to give you as of right now, and we're still finalizing our recruiting, is a preferred walk-on, knowing that we may be able to give you a scholarship in the spring. You know, and so that's what I had in the end. because Rice University, I was like, you know, that would be good, but I don't want to really be in, I don't want to be in Texas. Like I want to come outside the state lines. And so those are my two in the Northeast.
Well, I think you ended up at the right spot for a lot of different reasons. Yeah. One, I think that you ended up at the right level. I think that at Fordham, you were a player that you were able to play. You played a lot. But you weren't one of those guys that was like, geez, like looking back, you could have easily played, you know, in the ACC or something like that. Right. Like you were at the right level athletically. And then academically, you got to go to a great place. Yes. And then culturally, you ended up in the place that you were born in South Texas, or, you know, in Texas, but you really should have been, you were a New York City guy probably all along.
Yeah. At the heart. Most definitely.
So that's, I think, a great story. I think that, it is, the more I'm doing this, the more I'm thinking about all of these stories that are why an athlete ends up at the school that they're at. And, for you, like, I think that your story is how I think you'd want it to go, where an athlete like kind of knows what they want, and it's a mix of a lot of like interest coming in and being able like to sort out the picture well and seeing that this school has these things that I really like, and you have a good picture of yourself, you know what you want, and you just kind of like you end up like both in like both directions, like other schools like starting to narrow down their list and cutting you out, and you narrowing down your list and cutting things out until you get that perfect match where it's the right fit on all those different levels. And that's how I think it should work. Yeah. I think the story actually usually is this coach gave me a call. I ended up going there and it was fine. Like that's like more often the story.
Yeah, no, you know, I've always been the type, and that's how I found my profession too, to take what life gives you. I'm a realist, right? And so I understand where I'm at, regardless of what athlete I thought I could have been or was at any given time. I take what I have and I make the best out of it. Right. And, you know, and I knew I couldn't pass up the opportunity to go visit Fordham. It was so funny because I left this out, but I was getting letters for basketball as well. Mm. Right. As well as track. Right. So I was all regional track and field runner. And then we made state at 1.2. Right. And then in basketball, unanimous all selection for our district, where we had, I think, two of the top five teams in the nation. Okay. So that's where I was. And so the game that would have determined our playoff berth against the rival, we actually played against our rival high school, North Grand Prairie, was the day that I was going on my visit to Fordham. But I had to weigh my options. I'm like, look, like, what are the chances of me getting a big scholarship at a very well-known, well-to-do school playing basketball? And it was a hard conversation I had to have with the basketball coach. And you know what he told me? He said, if it was my son, I would tell him to go too. And we ended up losing that game, and we didn't make it to the playoffs.
Yeah.
And in the game before that, I maybe scored like 22, 24 points against that team. I did very well. So we would have won if I would have played. So you take everything that life gives you, and you have to make a decision, a real decision. I think that's what separates a successful person from somebody who finds themselves in this hole to where they're always blaming somebody else, right? I think that's super important to speak it into the universe and allow the universe to show you your path.
Yeah, so. I think that is really good advice that I think would be hard for athletes to follow, but they definitely need to. Because I think that that look in the mirror is very difficult for people. And and honestly, part of the problem too is the parents. It's hard for them too. It's hard for the parents to see to see the kid as what they are instead of what they see them as. And that becomes a self-reinforcing delusion, probably.
It's 100% a delusion. You have parents that literally will put their child on a pedestal and make them seem like they are the greatest players since Bo Jackson or whatever it may be. Like, but it's like, like, you've put them in a situation so that they can be the best player. Are you allowing them to play against guys who are just as good or better than them? Or are you putting them in situations to where you know they're going to be successful? And I think a lot of parents protect their kids all the way up into the point to where they can't do it anymore. And then you have kids being disappointed in their experience. My mom did not do that. She said, you better go and work. You better go and work. You do that. And so I agree with you 100%. A lot of parents give kids false expectations.
Yeah, yep. I, that's I think that's part of it. And I think it's just, you know, then what happens is whenever someone wants to give you good, real advice, it feels like a slap in the face. It feels like that they don't see, they're not seeing your potential. They're not seeing you the way that you see yourself, and it's their fault. And instead of like fitting that into the picture of how you should actually be viewing yourself.
Most definitely. Most definitely.
So after you graduate Fordham, how'd you end up deciding to get into personal training? Like, what was that decision like?
Okay. All right. So again, I took what life gave me. So I don't know if you remember, but there was a time, I want to say it was the Lehigh game. And leading up to that game in the meeting rooms, I was under a lot of emotional distress, a lot, right? And it had to do with my younger brother. Do you remember that? No,
I do remember that.
Okay, I think we may have had a conversation, but it was weighing down on me. There were some things that were going on, you know, that caused a lot of distress. Right. And so my mind was in two places. My mind was focusing on this coming game, my senior year, but it was also focused on what was going on in Texas and my obligation towards my family, which, you know, have always been something that I've held on strong to. So that issue never resolved itself. I was the one that had to resolve it. So leading up into my graduation, I made the decision to take care of him and I moved him up. Right. I moved him up to New York so that he can finish out high school. So he's a high school student. This is a kid. He's a high school student. I want to say at that time he was a freshman or sophomore. OK. So it was a decision because I thought I could still maybe do some camps and maybe walk on and try out for a team. I really did think that either at the Arena Football League or something like that. Right. I really did think that. But then I made the decision to move him up there before I graduated. Okay. While I was at Fordham, I didn't do any internships, but the one thing that I did do is I worked closely with the Dorothy Day Service and Justice, Community Service and Justice Center, and I volunteered my time a lot. So I would go to a local elementary school maybe once or twice a week and do enrichment programs with these kids for after school. And then their final project would be something that would get broadcast to their whole school. So I already had a knack for servitude. I love giving back to the community. And then I had this newfound love for business finance, specifically small business finance and entrepreneurship. So what did I do? I needed money. Okay. I knew I loved working out, athletics, having that competitive nature and you know, the health implications behind that. And then also I kind of knew how to run a business now. Okay. The final straw is there was a tragedy that happened. Okay. So when I graduated, I still didn't know what I was doing. I was helping out with the football team at one point, helping out with strength and conditioning. I was training a couple faculty members at the school while I was still before I graduated. I graduated a week after I graduated. My sister passed. She had been struggling with, you know, issues that a lot of people will call mental health, right? She complained of anxiety, depression, right? She, you know, and it's hard to talk about, but she, you know, resorted in so many ways to self-medicating. Okay. And I think a lot of people do that. And it's a huge epidemic right now of kids either putting themselves in a situation to where they become addicted, or they put themselves in a situation to where they don't mean to become addicted, but then they self-medicate and they end up losing their life. She lost her life a week after I graduated. I saw her on my graduation. We had our graduation dinner. The last words I said to her is, I love you. And I'm so glad that I was able to spend the last 8 years with you, because I didn't grow up with my older sister. Okay. And I kissed her, and I used to do this thing where I would give her a wet willy. And she was older than me. She was like 3 years older than me. And I gave her, she's like, oh my gosh, you're so nasty. That week later, literally the Saturday was the graduation. Next Saturday, she was gone. And so in the week, that was May. She passed, I think around May. I have it on May 24th. I think, or May 21st, and June 5th, I went in for an interview to be a trainer, because I wanted to bring all these things together, helping people with mental health, right, through physical means, using my ability and my newfound love for small business finance, okay, being able to make fast money so I could provide for my younger brother, and something that gave me the flexibility. So if I needed to go to PTA meetings, I could, which I had to do. And so then it was the right choice for me. I couldn't be in a 9-to-5. I wouldn't have been able to support him. Right.
Yeah.
So that was how that decision came. And it was an amazing decision.
Yeah. So you started off just like working at a normal gym.
Yes. So I was working out. I don't know if I should say the name. I don't want to give any promo, but I was working out of a box gym. They are one of the top gyms, franchise gyms here in the city. And I was there for about no more than 2 years, probably a little bit less than 2 years. And it was crazy because, you know, my work schedule, because I'm such a hard worker and I don't let anybody get inside in front of my goal. While my brother was going to school, right, he had to be at school at 8 or 9. I was leaving the house by 5:30, right? But I would make him breakfast, okay, around that time. I would get home around 10:30, 11 o'clock. He'd be already asleep. I would check over homework, okay? And then that was a cycle. And I would see him periodically on the weekends or whatever it may be, like if there was a time to where I could be there when he woke up or, you know, before he went to sleep, I would be there. But it was hard because when I worked for those first couple years, you know, my first paycheck wasn't anything. I got my first ticket because I didn't have enough money to pay for a Metro card. It was crazy, right? I mean, as a personal trainer at a big box gym, it's a 30-70 split unless you're doing the big numbers. And at the time when I first started, I was not doing that, right? Annually, when you know, the amount of money I made, I think I may have made like $20,000 my first year doing it. It was nothing. It was like, how am I actually surviving? Best believe there were days to where we would only use $20 for a week of groceries, and we made it stretch. It was like that, right? But by the time I got to my second year, I had it figured out. I had it figured out, right? You know, my schedule was full. I got better at planning about 3 or 4 months ahead as far as my business. I started making meaningful relationships. I landed gigs with Nike. I landed gigs with Tough Mudder. I landed gigs with a couple other brands as well. And I kind of got the hang of it. My rate increased. I was able to, you know, charge premium price because I had gotten educated. I actually asked my manager to actually pay for certification for me so that I can pay him back as I started making the money. So he actually had to pay for me because I didn't have enough money to do it. And thank God he did that because I probably wouldn't have been where I'm at right now. And then at that 2 year mark, I had enough business to where I can go and do my own.
Yeah. So you went off on your own. For some reason, what I pictured, I remember, you know, I don't know how much we were talking then, maybe a little bit, but mostly just like keeping track of each other through social media. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking like, all right, picturing you being out on your own, I was just picturing you taking like business people and stay-at-home moms out to like Central Park and doing like football workouts with them out in the park.
Know,
that's like,
right?
What I'm picturing. Is that what it was like?
Well, at first it definitely was like that because, you know, like because I wasn't making a lot of money in the gym just yet. And, you know, this gym was down off Lafayette Street, a little bit lower than Astor Place, you know, for any listener who is familiar with New York and Manhattan. I did have clients in Central Park that I would see them at like 5:30 in the morning, 6 o'clock with a suspension trainer that I would hook up on a basketball goal. And it was dark as hell at night. And you would see cops still strolling around patrolling. Right. And it would be freezing during the wintertime. And there was some times where I was going all the way up north to Pelham Bay Park training for $25 cash, right? Yeah, and so it was really a grind. Like I was really, really, really hustling, sleeping on the train while I would go from client to client. And so it was. So at first it was like that because that's all I knew. Hey, I'm gonna get the speed ladder. We're gonna do some cone drills, you know, things like that. We're gonna do some green bays. We're gonna, you know, drive our feet, whatever it may be, until I actually learned. Until I actually got pre and postnatal certified, until I actually learned how to program like a strength and conditioning coach, until I actually learned how to do corrective exercise. And I started elevating the way in which I would actually program out and train and assess clients. And literally my clientele, the demographic went from like the newly immersed college graduate into the real world to like the successful executive C-level client who has gyms in their office, or gyms in their condominiums, right? So my, as I elevated in my education and the way in which I handled my business, my clientele and a different demographic that I had also did that as well.
So are you working with any athletes or is it mostly just regular people? I don't know how to differentiate people, not athletes.
The normies.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like to say no one that I have is regular. I mean, like, you know, the individuals that I have are so extraordinary. And what's crazy is these aren't people you're going to be able to find, right? These are people who make it their business to keep a low profile. But they also are some of the most prominent, well-to-do, wealthy people that you may ever come across. But they're low profile, right? They're not in the public eye. And I have had quite a few athletes. I've had collegiate athletes. Actually trained a few players from Lehigh and Lafayette, lacrosse players. And one guy had phenomenal results. He didn't make the team his first year and then came back the next year and not only played the whole year, but was the most conditioned. He said his coach told him he was the most conditioned and most physical going into the season. And I also had a couple triathletes, professional triathletes and marathon runners.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about strength and conditioning for mm-hmm. athletes, because you know a lot more about it than I do.
Yeah.
What would your advice be for a high school athlete that wants to play college football? Like, what should they be doing?
Well, so the one thing that I got introduced to at Fordham, but I didn't really take it seriously, was flexibility training and mobility training. So not just pounding at your muscles and lifting weights and like wearing sleeves on your joints instead of fixing an issue. Your joints shouldn't hurt when you're working out. They should not hurt. If they're hurting, you're 9 times out of 10 doing something wrong. So one thing that I have now added to my arsenal to help, you know, athletes who, like my marathon runner, one of them, she fractured her hips because her hips were so tight. She fractured her foot. And this was all because her muscles were so tight and stressful on her bone that these things were fracturing. So the introduction of myofascial release, which is foam rolling and doing it the right way. Have you ever heard? You ever heard of that? Done that?
I've heard of foam rolling. That whatever the first thing you said was a little bit beyond me.
So when you foam roll, that's what you're doing. You're basically breaking up the fascia, and fascia is a connective tissue that they're now deeming as an organ that basically surrounds all the muscles and kind of unifies all the muscles. And it works closely with the nervous system as well. So when you're rolling over and you're manipulating this fascia, right? Think about when you get a massage and someone says you have a knot, right? Your muscles, they're integrated. They don't knot, right? They integrate. The fascia is what tightens up. So when they're breaking up those knots, they're breaking up the either scar tissue or the fascia that is no longer getting signaled from that nervous system, okay? It helps reactivate it.
Is the fascia, is that inside the muscle or is that like connecting the muscle to whatever?
It's a sheath. It's like it's a sheer, very thin membrane that covers the muscle.
Okay, so it's like the skin of the muscle in a way?
You can say it like that, yeah.
I'm trying to picture it. It's like the sausage casing.
Yes. Yes. That's the best way to put it. It is. Yes, exactly.
Okay. So that gets tight.
Yes. Yes. And they're now deeming it, I think in the past like 4 or 5 years, as an actual organ itself, as opposed to just some random tissue that connects the muscle. Okay. And so teaching athletes to understand that pain, especially prime example, knee pain, a lot of athletes, myself included, had knee pain. When you have pain in your body, that source of pain or that the area of pain that you feel it typically is simply a fire alarm. It's not the fire. So when you say, oh, my knees are hurting, so my knees may be bad, that's almost equivalent to you saying, hey, the fire alarm is going off. The fire alarm is broken. No, there's a fire. That's why the fire alarm is going off. So it's up to the fitness professional, the strength and conditioning coach, which I know a lot of them are getting better at now, at finding the issues that these players are having. A lot of it is a result of tight hips, okay? Lack of mobility in the extenders and the flexors. So you think about the quads, lack of mobility rotating in the transverse plane. And then also a lot of trainers and coaches not teaching their players to train laterally. I've seen that you've posted a couple videos of athletes training laterally, right? There's no reason why athletes at the professional level should have non-contact lateral injuries. There's no reason. If they're having non-contact impact injuries, lateral injuries, it's because they're not training. Their body has not adapted to the point to where they can plant and that ACL does not tear.
Yeah, I always pictured that actually as like, there might be a certain limit to the amount of, no matter how much you train your ACL or your connective tissues, that if you are that big and you change directions that fast, that there might be just a limit. But you're saying you don't think that that's the case.
I don't think that's the case. There's more and more, there's more and more research out there that is showing that it's not the case as well. Because when all of these athletes, I mean, take a look at a LeBron James's workout program. You're going to see him doing balance work on a foam pad and doing drills standing on one leg, training joint stability, okay, to strengthen the ligaments and tendons that surround that joint, right? It's not just about the muscle, and people are realizing that, right? Your muscle, I mean, your tendons and your ligaments can be developed. Now, because there is no blood flow or not as much blood flow to the ligaments and tendons as it is in the muscles, you do have to train it differently, okay? The muscles can heal within 24 hours. Your ligaments and tendons can't, and that's the issue. So when you're pounding every single day of your ligaments and tendons and don't allow that to recover, every single day you're creating tiny micro tears in those ligaments and tendons that are not being repaired. So then that's typically how those injuries happen, right? Because you're not allowing that repair. Whereas with the muscles, if you train your ligaments and tendons the same way you train your muscles, it's no reason why you say, oh, I can do it every single day. It's just pain. I can just ice it and I'll be good, right? But I think a lot of it, a lot of this research and a lot of this new way of coaching is coming because you no longer have the strength and conditioning coach who were inspired by the Arnold Schwarzeneggers, right? Who were bodybuilders, who would just simply do heavy back squats, heavy chest press, right? You now have strength and conditioning coaches being inspired by the athlete, okay? By watching what the athlete does on the field and saying, how can I simulate that in their training? As opposed to saying, hey, I watch Arnold Schwarzenegger get bigger and stronger. This the head coach of the football team want our athletes to get bigger and stronger. So we're going to do things that a professional Mr. Olympia did.
So let you me know? Just, I want to make sure I'm catching the right vibe here. But are you saying that like this bench pressing and squatting should be gone or just de-emphasized?
I feel like it should be. There's so many different ways to skin a cat. And I think the more you can stimulate an athlete's nervous system, the better prepared they will be. Okay. Train them for all scenarios. And that's the thing. So, you know, one thing that most trainers do is they do phase training, right? You may have an off season, an in-season training, and a postseason training. They all look different. They all look different. And the prime movements, the bench press, the overhead press, the deadlift, the back squat, there should be an emphasis placed on it because those are the things that are going to stress the nervous system the most, which will give your endocrine system excitement, which will cause a lot of the endorphins, the growth hormones, the natural boost in testosterone to happen. But you shouldn't do it all the time. There's other ways. Like instead of for me now, and I have obviously, like I said, I don't have a lot of professional athletes, but I have guys who are serious competitors and recreational athletes who do the Tough Mudders, who do triathletes and things like that. Instead of doing a squat throughout the whole year, there may be a 3-month period to where the main lift is a lunge, a step up, a side lunge, a split squat, or just simply a body weight pistol squat. And it serves the same purpose, but it doesn't stress the nervous system as much so that the recovery can happen much faster as you're strengthening the ligaments, the tendons, as well as the muscles.
So like what I'm hearing you say, tell me if this seems similar, is training to be good at sports is a multidimensional problem. There's mm-hmm. so many things going on. There's strength, there's flexibility, there's mm-hmm. there's, you know, this fascia, there's like connective tissue, all of these things. Because ultimately what you want an athlete to do is perform the best. It's not you yes. don't want an athlete to be the strongest. You want an athlete mm-hmm. to perform the best. And that yes. perform the best, strength is one dimension there, but there's a lot of these different dimensions.
Yes.
And what I'm hearing you say is that strength coaches are either only focused on the one dimension or they're overly focused on the one dimension.
Yes. Yes. And I think that comes with education, right? And granted, like at the NCAA level, I think at a big school, like these strength and conditioning coaches, they are educated. A lot of them are educated. You have to be CSCS certified, which is a very big certification. It's one of the top certifications. And the amount of education that these coaches have to get is very intense. Okay. But I know, you know, from experience that it's easy to fall back on what you're comfortable with and include that into how you train your athletes. So, you know, I was always a believer that, like, your athlete is going to be a reflection of you. So the things that you're good at is what your athlete is going to be good at, right? I think as a coach, what you brought to us was critical thinking, point blank. That is something, like, you'll tell them, like, you weren't a big football player or anything like that, but, like, you understood the game at a level that I think the average athlete wouldn't, because of the amount of film that you studied and because your background in understanding data and analyzing that. So then what you were able to bring to us that the average coach wasn't able to bring was that critical thinking on the field and off the field, how we can break down film, what we should look for, what are some of the techniques, right? Could you teach us what it feels like to take on impact? Probably not. Could you teach us what it feels like to be in a large stadium of athletes? Probably not, of audience, probably not. But you were able to give us that critical thinking. A strength and conditioning coach, if what he knows and what he's comfortable with is bodybuilding style, Olympic lifting, and that's what he's done, but he may have never played at a high level of Division I football or never been a starter on a Division I program, you're only going to be as good as that strength and conditioning coach. It's important for that coach to be able to relate to those athletes so they can understand what that athlete is going to go to.
Well, most people that I've met that have become strength and conditioning coaches at the collegiate level became that because they loved the Olympic style lifting. That was like that to them was strength and conditioning. They loved it. Yeah. And so, like, that's probably why they focus on it.
Yeah, but your defensive back shouldn't be doing the same lifts as your offensive lineman.
Yeah.
The nature of their actual job on the field is different.
Yeah.
If you work for an investment bank, each job title and each role is going to be different, right? And what you need to study, what you need to bring to the table is going to be different, even if the goal is a collective goal to make more money for your company, right?
Yeah. So I was going to say, what resources are out there for an athlete that is listening to this that says, okay, I'm not getting probably the thing I need from my high school strength and conditioning coach. Mm-hmm. I need to, like, focus more on things that are going to make me more flexible, more durable, stronger in the ways that are actually going to help me to perform, meaning, like, are going to help make me faster and quicker and, you know, be able to put on the brakes faster.
Yeah.
What resources are there out there? Like, is there, like, a website that people could go to get good information on this kind of thing?
Oh yeah. There's so much information out there. I mean, you could just, ask, worldwide Google, but like, just the preface this, you know, the one thing is that young athletes should focus on are, strength endurance, okay? Strength endurance, or as you would say, muscular endurance, cardiovascular endurance, right? Flexibility training and body composition. All three, all those things are going to make you a better athlete. Now, you can literally search on Google and find great information about how to become more flexible as an athlete. There's so many resources. I mean, for me, I read textbooks, I read journals. So, like, my knowledge comes from sources of, like, say, for instance, Harvard Medical or stuff like that. Like, I like reading journals, right, or textbooks. So, like, me personally, I'm certified through an organization called National Academy of Sports Medicine, NASM, NASM. But there's also ACE, American Council of Exercise, right? And so, in these programs are, you know, relatively inexpensive to get into. Even though I had to have my manager pay for my book at first, but there's so much of what is in that textbook that's online as well. And they preach these things and they will teach you how to be a better athlete just by searching, how can I work on, transferring lateral movement on and off the field or whatever it may be that I can prevent ACL tears.
I just worry that, like, you type that into Google, you get a lot of different things, and some of them are good advice and some of them are bad advice. I was wondering if you had, like, a go-to, or at least a couple of go-tos that you think are places that generally offer good advice.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my knowledge is going to come from either, like I said, the journal articles from top universities that deal with sports medicine, and also NASM. So if you go on the NASM website, NASM.org, literally there's so many resources, and they have, like, corrective exercise for basketball, and they have extensive research a lot of case studies that show why their method is proven to work. They use something called the optimum training model, which focuses on cardiovascular training, core balance, plyometric training, and strength and conditioning. So that's definitely a great resource for our young athletes. But obviously, the only barrier is that you do have to put money into it to find a lot of those resources.
And I don't know if, were you at Fordham when the strength coach John Krasinski was there?
I missed him.
Okay. He,
because I heard he was amazing.
So
amazing.
It's interesting. I want to dig into that. He also has the unfortunate name of being the exact same name as a famous actor, but it's not the same person. Different guy. I'm curious, who was giving you the impression that he was amazing? Where were you hearing that from?
Well, because when I was helping out with coaching, I was helping out with the defensive backs, and I would see some of the things that they were doing. And I was also helping out with some of the athletes. Like, I would work with some of the athletes that were currently playing, like do footwork drills with them and things like that. And I would ask them, like, what type of drills and exercises does the coach have you doing? And he was like, and these players were saying, well, we do a lot of unilateral work. And when I hear that, I'm like, okay, he's teaching y'all something. He's teaching. Not saying that prior to that we weren't learning anything, but like, it's different. It's innovative. It's up to par with what was currently happening in the industry, right? And so they were doing a lot of single leg work, a lot of balance work, right, and things like that. That is important for the common athlete, especially if you're on the field and you're in the demands of that field. Means that you have to be able to stop at the drop of a dime, change directions, and then be able to do that full speed, you know?
Yeah, because I, you know, hearing you talk, his strength and conditioning program, it seemed like he was probably getting information from similar resources as you. It sounded familiar in that way. I do think that it was interesting because I've thought about that a lot because I think two things happened during his tenure. Number one, we got a lot better.
Oh my gosh.
We got a lot better as a football team.
Three championships?
Yeah. From like not very good at all.
Yeah.
And
our first winning season the first winning season that I was there was my senior season.
Right.
I mean, I think it first had to do with Coach Joe Moorhead, who is now at Mississippi State.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Cool. I want to make sure. And then the championships happened when we had that huge turnover in the strength and conditioning. So that proves a lot of my point too.
Well, I was going to say though, the other thing that happened at the same time around that is I think that in general, the feeling from coaches, I'm not sure players, but coaches was that he was some combination of lazy and like not doing things the right way. And I wonder how much of that is like that meathead mentality in football, getting like passing judgment on something that's maybe newer, better, actually produces good results, but it's just like not as tough and hard-nosed, like kind of like way of thinking.
Yeah, I think, and I ask, you know, a lot of clients and athletes, they do consult with me and ask me, like, even though I don't have professionals, but I do get asked a lot of questions through email, through social media all the time, right? And as a fitness professional and as a trainer, it's important for us to use not only what we know about the industry and what we know about the body, but also our creativity. And I think the hardest thing is to find that fine line between tough and between smart. That's the hardest thing to do.
Yeah. I think that, that's totally true. Cause there is, I think you're never going to have a good football team unless if it's a tough football team.
Yeah.
And I think that it's partially the responsibility of the strength and conditioning coach on the team to develop that toughness.
Yeah, definitely.
When I was at Rutgers, I thought they did this like really good way of doing winter workouts.
Uh-huh.
Where the winter workouts were actually very easy if you were mentally tough.
Yeah,
if you
were
not mentally tough, they were difficult as hell. Because it was set up where they put like all of like the athletes that like are always doing the right thing all the time, like in a group together. And then like the second tier in that like tight way of thinking in a group together, the third tier that way in a group together. And then like all the athletes that were like the worst at following directions, the worst at like doing the right thing all the time, being disciplined, like all the they were all in a group together. And the way how it would work is they would a group would go through an exercise, and if they followed all if everyone in the group followed all the instructions correctly, that they would like pass through and get to the other side. If they didn't, then they would go to like a quick like I don't know like punishment station where they would do like say 10 up downs as a group and then go to the back of the line.
Right? Yeah.
And so you can imagine that when you're in the group of like all the guys that do the things the right way, almost every time they would just like pass right through, and the exercise was like actually quite easy for them. They would pass right through and then they would wait.
Yeah.
When you get to that last group, the odds that all five of like the least disciplined people on the team would do like that mentally like draining thing when you're already tired well was like impossible. And so they would like continuously get punished and punished and punished and go around and around. And I thought that was like such an interesting way to, for your best players that are already mentally tough, like they don't get like grinded into oblivion. But for the guys that really needed that grinding, that increase in mental toughness, they got it.
It should always be specific to the needs of the players. And what you were just mentioning, I think some of that culture, where did Coach at the time, he actually went to, I think, Tampa Bay. But Coach Lukaku, he was a Rutgers guy, right?
Yeah.
And I remember when Coach Joe Moorhead started bringing his staff over, and I remember the one thing that he would say, you pay attention to detail. The next thing that he would say that I would never forget is you got to earn the right to win. So I specifically remember during winter conditioning, this is crazy, and I love this so much, right? And when I teach my young athletes, my youth, you know, within youth sports, you earn the right to win. The winners were the ones that would do sprints.
Yeah.
That's this. That's all that is. You've earned the right to do sprints. You've earned the right. You won, right? And the people who are on the sideline had to watch the winners do their sprints. Now, it's kind of twisted, but it does definitely set you up to where it's like, you know what? Like, this is not a punishment run. Doing extra work is not a punishment run. It's going to make me better. But I think, you know, just to your point, like, mental toughness is important for a game like football. It's a very violent sport, and you have to find a way to make it so that it's the survival of the fittest.
Yeah,
you want the best athletes on the field at all times, and you want to make sure that you're not wasting your time with athletes who just probably don't have it.
Yeah, and you know, football is certainly not the only sport. Like, I actually also think I think of like wrestling as maybe being like the number one sport that like demands
that
this.
This
muscle, but football, I think more than most team sports, because of the physical nature to it. I think that there's like, when you're locked up with someone else, like it is just as much a battle of strengths as it is a battle of wills in order to like, who's going to like win that locking up, right? Like if you're trying to get off a block and they're trying to block you, or you're trying to tackle someone, they're trying to not get tackled, in a way that I think is like similar in wrestling. But in wrestling, it's even more intense because it's like so one-on-one.
Yeah, definitely.
But like I said, I think football is unique in that way in a team sport, and developing that skill and that muscle. This reminds me again of like another coach I used to work for. He had a couple of things that he would do, but one of the patterns of like the ways that he would do it is the exercises would get tougher and tougher and tougher throughout the year, even like in season, which is like not that typical.
Yeah, you progress it.
So I know our Sundays, I'm trying to remember like our Sundays, like our non, like after the game, like we, not like real practice, it was like a fake practice. We mostly film in like 30 minutes of like not a practice, but just kind of like an exercise. It was like a stretching thing, and then it would end with like full like 100-yard runs. And it would either be like, I remember it would be like, he'd be like half jog full, and that would mean like, for the first 33 yards, you would go half speed, and then you would jog for the next 33 yards, and then you would sprint for the last 33. Anyway, I remember like at the end, he would always like at the end of the first week, it was like the last one of those things were like full, full, full. So you would sprint like the whole 100 yards. And then the second week, you would do two of those. And the third week, you do three of those. And like on the third week, the third one seems like impossible. Mm-hmm. But on like the 10th week, the third one is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was, and like that's like an example. He would do that same type of pattern in other ways.
Yes.
And then
yes.
at the end of the season, like he would make you reflect on that idea that
how far you came.
Yeah. Well, not just how far you came, but also like that your running three was really just a mental block.
It
like,
was
that third one was hard because you let that thing be hard.
Yes. It's true. It's so true. And it's what you're talking about right now is progressing the human body. We have something very, very unique about us. We can take on a lot of demand on our body. And there's this theory called the general adaptation syndrome that we have, to where when you give us something, okay, and it overloads our system, or we see it as hard in this case, our body overcompensates. So we end up working harder to try to complete it. And it takes us away from homeostasis, which was our norm. A good coach, a good trainer, a good fitness professional understands that I'll overcompensate, then try to go back to normal. And we have to hit it right as we're going back down and progress even more. So it's a smart way to be able to get a person to go from, I can't do something, I'm mentally weak, this is too hard, to saying, wow, I'm almost invincible. So it's progression. And that's what you have to do with your training too. And which is one of the reasons why you can't just do back squats for a year straight. You should progress. Teach a person, start with back squats and say, hey, we're going to do, you know, your body weight times two in back squats. And then month one, we're going to learn how to do pistol squats. Then we're going to learn how to do lunges with heavy weight on your back. Then we're going to learn how to do step ups. Then we're going to learn how to do pistol squats with weight, whatever it may be. And then at the end of that year, let's do back squats heavy again. And you're going to see that was nothing, right? You know? So yeah, I hear you on that, just to put some context in my industry.
Yeah, so. Cool. That's cool. So I know you know, you went from Texas to New York City, you graduated college, you like started at the bottom and then made it to like the top of like the strength and conditioning world. You've done really great for yourself. And I think that, you know, your mentality is a huge reason why that's the case. It doesn't surprise me that the same things that made you successful when you were in high school and got you to college, got you mm-hmm. from college all the way through, and then got you from that to where you are now. Mm-hmm. But I know like you have some thoughts on the NCAA and like their role in helping people that graduate, the people that are student athletes, find their way and help them to be successful after they leave college. I wanted to hear what you think about that.
Yeah. So, all right. So what sucks about the conversation that happens amongst athletes, especially athletes that receive scholarships, okay, is, you know, we always talk about, should athletes be paid, right? And I think that's a huge conversation that I don't think anybody has actually solved. And even with clients now who never played at the collegiate level, they say, well, you know, like, do you think you should be paid if you get a full ride scholarship and everything paid for? And I'm a man who understands that current investment will yield future results. And I think these universities understand that too, right? And I specifically will go back to an example. When my senior year, we played against Cincinnati, the University of Cincinnati. There's a contract that's getting signed. And as a university, we're getting money to play against Cincinnati. We're going to get some money, right? A good chunk amount of money. The first thing that I remember, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, is, this is going to allow us to do this for our facility, for the team. But you guys that are actually playing are not going to be able to see that. It's going to be for the future, right? Now, what about the student athlete who came as a top recruit, who tore his ACL three times and now has a family of three, who doesn't have anything to go back on besides a thought and a memory of, oh, I used to play Division I football with the full scholarship? Why wasn't there anything set aside for them? Maybe a fund, maybe a trust that says, hey, you know, if you complete the 4 years as a student athlete, part of this scholarship money is going to go to a trust, to a fund, right? That's going to be maybe ran and governed by a division of the university you went to, right? We're going to make sure that it grows and you're going to get X amount of return and you'll be set up for at least 5 years after you graduate. There's too many athletes that I know that go in thinking the same way that medical students who choose to be med students go in saying, hey, I'm going to get a job in my field. Now, it may not be private practice, but I know for a fact I can go to a hospital and work at least for a decent income, right? The athlete doesn't have that. Semi-professional football players don't make money. $100 a game? You can't support your family with that. But then we're expected to perform at a high level, at the collegiate level, in front of all of these fans, make money for all of these universities, make money for the NCAA, and get nothing forward if we don't make it professional. And it's been proven already that when you have a very successful athletic program, it increases the application rate. It increases the application rate for the student body of that school, okay? Now, what does that mean for the university? You have a successful program, okay? Your team is winning. the amount of money in the future that that school is going to get because of that winning team, I'm pretty sure, I could be wrong, probably will amount to a little bit more than any money that any student 10 years out of school is going to donate back to that university. I could be wrong, but I'm almost positive, because there's a lot of athletes that play Division I ball. And there's also a lot of students that graduate, a lot of students that I know who have very good jobs, and I ask them, have they donated back to the school? And they haven't. I'm making my choice. I'll give back to the school already. Once I started making good money, once I started hitting the multiples of six figures, I'm donating back to the school, right? But these athletes who go in and have nothing to show for it besides the fact that, yeah, I have pictures of me playing at a very well-known athletic program in a very well-known school, that doesn't get them anything. It may get them in front of somebody who may be an alum. They may be able to land a job because they're a hard worker. And there's so many different implications that come with being a college athlete. But like, there needs to be some type of responsibility that either the university takes or that the NCAA takes when they are giving these scholarships to athletes, especially if the athletes are graduating and they're graduating with great grades, right? And they're going to represent the school even after they actually leave.
So you're like picturing like some sort of pension of some kind.
Something. Like I watched my roommate have three ACL tears. And hands down, he was one of the best running backs I've seen personally. Langston. I don't know if you were there. He was amazing. Non-contact injuries. Like, I was for sure Langston was going to, you know, I was for sure. I was like, yo, he's going to be, he's tough, right? Boom. Three kids, a wife, he's doing well, right? But it's like, dang, like, he basically has destroyed his body. He didn't even get his last surgery. He destroyed his body for this thought that he was going to represent a school off of this scholarship. And now he, like, it's nothing.
Yeah, so you think that, like, the scholarship isn't enough, right? That's like, you know, I think that's the general, that's like the general argument is that, like, why do you think athletes do it if it's not enough?
Go take the scholarship?
Yeah, instead of just
because a lot of athletes were like me. A lot of athletes came, you know, and I don't know the statistics, but I'm only assuming because of the athletes that I know. I know you had a former teammate of mine, Issa Abdul Qaddous from Union, New Jersey, right? A lot of athletes have this vision of being on the big screen, right? So we all come in with the mindset that, yo, I'm gonna make it. And at the collegiate level, you're that close. You're not the top 1% that goes professional, but you're damn near close. Like, you're really that close. You're one step away from being a professional athlete. So that's why they do it. Because once you get to that main stage, you could sign that contract for either, I think, minimum, which is $425,000, right?
Yeah.
Or potentially get a couple million dollars.
And, you know, I guess like I don't want to come off as like someone that totally disagrees with you, because I don't. But I do want to poke holes in your thinking. So like, so I can understand it better. Mm-hmm. But it just sounds like to me that you're saying that the NCAA should be responsible for athletes and their own delusions.
I mean, well, I was in a video game. There was a class action lawsuit that happened. I don't remember signing up to be on EA Sports and NCAA, right?
Right. Well, they got rid of that.
I know. You know why? Because they realized that they were abusing their power and they were exploiting athletes.
Totally.
And Point blank.
So in that case, it is clear that I don't know if they just got rid of it because of the fear over being ruled against, or if it was like that they were actually ruled against. But obviously, they thought that there was a good enough case there where they shouldn't have the likeness. What I do think actually happened is that the schools became fearful of probably like losing this NCAA model that they have, which is pretty good for them. Mm-hmm. And so they collectively backed out of that deal with EA Sports. Mm-hmm. I think that's actually mm-hmm. how that went down.
I'm sure.
Like, for them, like, the EA Sports thing was a small thing. And so for them, like, to be able to back out was like totally worthwhile. In order to prevent like the risk of that like becoming the end of the thing that they have. I was gonna say that I think at the end of the day, like, I agree with the sentiment that it seems like the pie is not being divided up the right way.
Yeah, definitely.
Right? And I think it's probably, and it is that way for clear reasons, that the athletes don't have a say at the table. Like no one is at, no one is bringing in current athletes to figure out like how we, how they should divide the pie. And as a result, they get less of a pie. And I think actually the same thing happens in the NFL for rookies. Rookies get less of the pie than they probably should too, for the same reason, because it's the NFL Players Association, which are veterans essentially, negotiating with the league. And so they get, you know, like that's how the short end of the stick gets decided. But I think like the problem is like how far should that go and for whom? I think are like the details to be worked out. Like, should it be every NCAA athlete gets like some small bit, or should it be based on your like a normal marketplace where it's like based on how desirable you are, where Reggie Bush should get 10 million and a Division III player should get zero? And like, I mean, how should that work?
I mean, I think that if I was to make a suggestion, I think that there definitely has to be guidelines and rules as far as you completing school, what your GPA may be, your average GPA may be, the impact that the years that you were there had on that school and how much money that school made. I think that there's a way we can come up with some type of formula. Do I think that each player should get something? I think maybe not. Okay. But I do think that there should be something in place. I mean, those are answers that I don't have. I mean, I've explored the conversation with people who are actually working towards making something like this happen. And, you know, just going back to, like, parents aren't educating their kids because they don't understand the process, right? And I'll take this in a different direction. I'm so, like, he's a character, but I'm glad to see a guy like LaVar Ball doing what he has done, because he has said, I'm not going to let my kids be taken advantage of. And you know what he did? He started his own basketball league. Now, it's a new league. He's trying to fund it himself. He's, you know, like the kids, they get paid, I think, 10 grand a month to play, right? And they're still developing and they still have the opportunity to play professional, right? They can choose not to go to, there's a lot of kids who come to college just to play football or just to play basketball because they think they're going to go professional, and they're not cut out to be in the academic portion. They're not cut out to compete academically, right? But then you still force a lot of kids to go through this NCAA program when they didn't even really want to be in the classroom. They just wanted to play a sport.
Yeah. So my response to that is, I think for what it's worth, I think that the model as it currently exists gives many, many, many more people college degrees that otherwise wouldn't have them and give them the opportunity to be successful in life than I think like almost any other version of this model would give you. Yeah, and but so college, like that to the plus side.
Sure. But we all know that with the education system here, when college degrees, you can have I know people who are overly qualified who are maybe 10 years my senior who have a hard time finding a job. So college degrees, yes, it matters. Masters, PhDs, it matters, but that doesn't guarantee you anything. That just shows that you have the ability to complete a task if that company wants you, right? So like, yes, it's an argument, and yes, it is a value, right? I appreciate my degree, that business finance degree. I appreciate it, and when I go into the office with my client who is running a $1 billion company, they know what's up. They know I'm Bloomberg Terminal certified. They know I'm value investing certified, right? I have the same teachings that they're teaching over. Benjamin Graham was teaching and things like that. So like I have that knowledge and that foundation, but it still does not give any type of security to the athlete after they're done playing. There's no security. Again, I'll say, if you are an accountant, right? If you get an accountant degree and you studied that for 4 years, the same amount of time that an athlete will play football for 4 years, say you got an academic scholarship, I guarantee you can go to a huge investment bank. You can go and probably work at a hedge fund, or you can go to a Bank of America with that degree and you can get a job. Point blank. I play 4 years of football, 4 years anything. You know what my options are? To potentially become a coach as an intern and make nothing for the first 2 years and potentially make something the third and fourth and fifth year, or try to go and pursue a sports, lose even more money by trying to play, try out for an arena football team while probably having a regular 9-to-5, making minimum wage, and probably never even seeing it again. There's no other outlet for these athletes after they sacrifice their body, potentially have concussions, right? We talk about black matter in the head, representing, having our picture posted all on the school, having our picture posted all on TV. But then after we're gone, there's no more of us. There's no more.
Yeah, I think that the idea is, and to the extent that this is reality, I think is mixed. I think it's mostly true. Is that the trade is you're gonna give your time, body, energy, effort towards playing football or whatever sport, right? And yes. In exchange, you are going to get a degree in something that's not athletics. You're gonna get a degree in something of your own choosing, with some limitations, but very little limitations. And then as a result, you're going to have that opportunity to then take that degree and do what you want with it. And at the same time, you're also going to get the experience of playing college football, which I think there's Division III athletes that are not getting any scholarship that are willing to trade that whole list of things that they're willing to trade just for the experience of playing college football.
Sure.
With no scholarship and no money.
So my question is, why does the NCAA give scholarships at the amount of $300,000? What does the NCAA get out of that?
Yeah, I mean, like, obviously they get all the things that you and I both know. I'm just saying that the deal that's being, I think you're mischaracterizing the deal that is currently being struck. Not necessarily that I'm saying that the deal that's currently being struck is fair, but I think that you should characterize it correctly and then say why it's not fair instead of like mischaracterizing it. I think you're mischaracterizing in the sense that you're making it sound like that these athletes are not also getting a four-year degree in something that's not athletics. Like they could get a degree in accounting like you or business like you did and use it.
But that's not the average athlete. Everybody knows that. The most athletes go and get communication degrees because it's easier. I know a lot of phenomenal athletes that I played with at the university I went to, which is one of the most prominent universities in the nation, who opted to getting something like communications because they came into it saying, I have this scholarship. School isn't for me, but I know if I get a degree from this university, it can be good, even if I get something in communications.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that was that athlete's, that was that person's choice.
Sure, 100%. But so, then how do you like, and you're talking about kids who come to this completely new space and typically don't have the legal coaching, the understanding of their personal value from home. We just signed papers. I just signed a paper. I can't even tell you what the scholarship paper from the NCAA said. You know why? Because they were like, this is your scholarship. Sign it. I wasn't taught that. If I would have known better, I would have went back in 2009. What I would have tried to see is, yo, is there a way that I can like trademark my name or trademark my likeness so that if the NCAA wants to use it, I could actually make money and they actually pay me for using that? Is there a way I can do that? All contracts can be negotiated. Right. And that's also why I say I respect a LeVar Ball, because he's like, yo, like there definitely has to be a way. Right. Because the NCAA shouldn't be the only way that a player can be able to go professional. It shouldn't be. There should be. And I know it takes a lot of money. Other avenues to where athletes can go to the professional stadium. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I know athletes. I mean, again, I mean, God bless his soul. But damn. Like my friend, my ex-teammate, who I still share moments with, he'll never play football again. He'll never play football again.
Neither will you.
Neither will I. Right? It's done. Right? It's not a career that you can have for life. So if that, like, I think that it, I mean, and we probably will disagree and, you know, continue, which is okay. But I think there is some responsibility because, you know, like, four years of not getting paid. I just paid off my college debt. That's me. I know a lot of people who are still paying off college debt, right? All they had was a scholarship.
Yeah, but athletes are paying off. But the athletes are paying off less than the non-athletes.
Maybe.
Much less.
Maybe.
Or none, if you have a full scholarship.
And it's relative. I mean, if you take, say, for instance, the non-athlete who had the opportunity to spend most of their time studying in the classroom and not competing on the field, which I had to do both in the classroom and on the field, and you say, well, all of their 100% time was dedicated to that and maybe partying and maybe volunteering and maybe doing internships, whereas my time was spent, I ran track and played football at Fordham. I was a multi-sport athlete, right? My time is split, but I'm still looked at by that professor to compete in the classroom.
Yeah, well,
so that time and dedication towards your actual profession is going to be much more thorough if you're just a student, if you're just a student versus a student athlete.
Yeah. And I know you have to go, so I'm going to let you go. And I always want to give you the last word, so I'm not going to put my two cents in on top of that. But the nice thing is
a conversation. I think this dialogue has to happen, because I think through talking about it and through hearing different viewpoints from it, it can give us all a different perspective, right? Because even from you giving me the perspective that you have, I'm like, okay, yeah, that does make sense. That, you know, I should give the NCAA a little bit more credit, right?
Yeah. I guess now I'm tempted to give my two cents a little bit, all I'm saying is that I think what it is my view is that there's a deal that's been reached, mm-hmm. and the deal as it currently is still a good enough deal for athletes where they're taking it. And there's many more people that want to take it than there are spots for them to take it. So, yeah. This argument that it's not a good deal, I don't think is genuine. Now, in that sense, that it's not a better deal than just being a regular student.
Yeah,
it is a better deal.
Yeah, okay.
Because everyone is wanting it. Now, that being said, being an NBA superstar is a better deal than being, you know, just like an accountant, let's say, right? And and just because you're getting the opportunity to be an NBA superstar doesn't mean that you should have to like give in to whatever the NBA wants to give you. You should still be able mm-hmm. to negotiate and have like the fairest deal that makes the most sense. And I agree with you that the deal is not as fair to student athletes as it should be. I think that is mostly true at a level probably above Fordham where you play.
Yeah.
I think at that level, the deal is probably pretty close to fair. That's my opinion.
Okay.
I think the deal is not that fair for, say, the top, you know, 500 recruits in the country, because mm-hmm. They are bringing in substantially more revenue than the quality of the deal that they're getting.
That's true.
And then I think, though, at the end of the day, what you have to decide is, like, what are you valuing? And for me, like, what I value is, I think that it's a balance between, like, what is fair and what is equal. I don't know, like, this is my idea. This is how I frame it, is...
Not equal, but what equates.
No, sorry. It's like, I'm thinking of those as two different things. So, like, what fair is, like, someone is getting paid what they deserve for their service, right? That's fair.
Mm-hmm.
But what's equal is, like, let's say, like, you have a choice. You could either spend the $10 million and give it to Reggie Bush, or mm-hmm. you can spend that $10 million by providing a four-year college degree to a ton of athletes at USC that like play in wrestling and in swimming and in so you're taking that money that the school is bringing in for their athletics program, and then they're spending it probably like a little foolishly on other things as well, and probably spending more on things that they otherwise wouldn't have. But like at the end of the day, like there's a lot of non-revenue sports where athletes are getting four-year degrees and scholarships that I think that is a really good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But so like that would be that like creates more equality, meaning that like there's more people being brought into the boat and getting something instead of like it being totally fair. Right. And I think that balance plays out in society as well. I mean, like there's people that think that taxes should be higher and there should be more like goods and services available from the public, you know, from the public mm-hmm. pool. And then there's people that think that no, taxes should be lower. And if you make more money, you should deserve to have more money and people should be more on their own. And I think that those arguments are like totally valid. And the balance has to be struck somewhere like,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, in the middle. And I think that's the argument, and that's what we have to figure out. And I think I agree with you that it's not fair enough, or it's not, it's not fair enough. It's too equal, not fair enough.
Yeah, it should definitely be, and I have a similar balance, equality versus equity, right? I feel like they're different. Equality is like one-to-one, whereas equity is like, I mean, you know, it's a financial term, right? So, you know, if I have this car, what does that equate to in dollar amount, right? So, I mean, I do think they're just like every other system that we have, whether you look at a law, whether you look at a legal system, whether you look at the software on your iPhone, it should always be updated. It should always be revisited, right? That's
totally.
A good analogy, right?
That's
it should
good.
Always be revisited. And I think that there needs to be basically more questions to the athletes on how they feel about it, right? And I think that the athlete needs to be heard. And I think it sucks that the athlete gets educated after about the options that they could have exhausted after their 4 years, right? And so, like I said, like, I don't know if that could work. I mean, when I have a son, maybe I'll see if I can trademark his likeness and type. You know what I'm saying? To see, like, yo, if the NCAA wants him, I'm gonna make sure he's the best possible athlete. He's gonna, his company, his LLC that's under his name is gonna get paid if y'all are gonna be using his picture. If y'all are gonna be putting him and promoting him and having him on billboards and selling him to the student body, right? And I think that also is parenting. We talked about that earlier. It's parenting, right? So I think there's a lot of education that needs to get done to the athlete, right? For the athlete and also for the family, and the family understanding that you shouldn't rely so much on the NCAA to get where you want to get. And I think that's the issue. And I think if more families and more students realize that, then that system would change and we would have another system. But right now, a lot of athletes are dependent on that scholarship. A lot of kids at the age of 8, 9, 10, they want to work. They want to play for a University of Texas, right? A lot of kids, they grow up being the best and thinking that they're going to be wearing that Dallas Cowboy jersey one day, right? And a lot of parents think that as well. But I think there does need to be a middle ground. And I think everybody deserves to have some sort of cushion if they're giving any type of service. Right. We do it in any other industry, every other, you know, talk about the military, the benefits you get for being a veteran after your 4 years. OK, you talk about the NFL, the pension that you get after playing 4 years. A lot of players don't get that after 4 years. Right. Because they don't make it to 4 years. You talk about working a regular corporate job and retiring. Right. So I think if that is going to be something, I played football since I was 6 years old. My whole life has been that. There's not too many other professions that a kid at the age of 6 did their whole life. I learned about finance and accounting when I got to Fordham. Like, thank God I did, but that's when I learned about it. So I think there should be a middle ground. And I think the student athlete is becoming smarter. I think people are becoming more and more aware of their options. And I think it's a good thing. And I think there will be change in the next 5-10 years.
I think so too. But Rob, you got some fancy people to go off and go train. I want to get you out of here.
I got to make people healthy.
But the nice thing is we can get you back on and we'll do this again.
Definitely, man. I would definitely love to continue this conversation. And, you know, it's I have some notes that I jotted down here. I'm going to definitely do my own personal research. This is what I like doing. Like, even though my profession is being a fitness professional and coaching people on how to be the healthiest, happiest, most exceptional person that they can be, you know, I also have other interest in giving back to a group of people, such as athletes, that I feel like I came from. That's my community. The athlete and that athletic body is my community. So it's my duty to be able to have my say so in how they should be able to go about their 4 years and pursue their dream, even if they're not good enough to play professional. So I definitely will want to come back on, man. This is phenomenal. I love what you're doing at Verified Athletics. You know, it's encouraging because I didn't have a platform when I was getting recruited as the one that you're trying to create, where I had resources and direct contact with college coaches, with ex-NFL players, with ex-players who may have not played, you know, professional ball, and to be able to get that insight. So what you and your team are doing is pretty phenomenal. Pretty phenomenal.
Well, thanks.
And it's affordable.
Well,
you know,
it's free. So
exactly.
It's all free.
Exactly.
Where can people find out more about you or follow you on social media?
All right. So, currently right now, if you check out my company is Be Exceptional. And we go under Be Exceptional Fitness and Be Exceptional Meals. So I have a meal service that I actually, just started, but if you go to www.beexceptionalfitness.com, I have a lot of content. I have workouts for the athlete as well as the non-athlete on there that can be purchased. I do a weekly newsletter where we tackle everything revolved around the lifestyle around health and fitness. On Instagram, you can find me at Robert L. Palmer, my personal page where I post a lot of motivational videos, some of my travels and exploration across the world. I do train abroad. I get invited to various places to train abroad. So the Mexico, Jamaica, DR. A lot of times I'm working while I'm there. I get invited as the New York trainer. And then my company has a page, Be Exceptional Fitness, on Instagram. So that's at Be Exceptional Fitness, at Robert L. Palmer, and then www.beexceptionalfitness.com. So
Awesome. Well, if you ever get a fancy client up here in the suburbs in Connecticut, make sure to hit me up on your way.
This summer, I'm actually doing some work. I also do gym design. There's a whole bunch of things we got to catch up on. Right. So I have a gym that I'm a personal gym that I'm designing up there this summer.
Man. Well, it was great talking to you. And all right. we'll do this again. See you around.
Definitely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Most of my guests are former college football players, and the topic of athletes getting paid just keeps coming up. Rob was no exception. Is it a problem that is not getting solved because it's a hard problem to solve, or just because the people that are making the decisions have no incentive to make drastic changes to the current system? I'm not sure, but I think it's obvious to me that we'll continue to explore it on this podcast. Rob had a lot of interesting things to say on that and other things, so I look forward to having him back on. And if you're enjoying this podcast or our articles on the Recruiting Academy, please share them. See you next time.